Case number 13-3039, United States of America versus Yossi Razo Nunez, appellant. Ms. Toramina for the appellant, Mr. Smith for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, Rosanna Toramina for appellant Yossi Razo Nunez. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In sentencing Mr. Razo Nunez, the district court in this case committed two critical errors, one factual and one legal. Both are procedural in nature, they are straightforward, and they both require remand for resentencing. With respect to the error of fact, the district court sentenced Mr. Razo Nunez under the mistaken belief that the violation of supervised release for which he was being sentenced represented the third time that he had unlawfully entered the United States, when in fact Mr. Razo Nunez had only once before been convicted of unlawful reentry.
The judge seemed concerned about recidivism generally, right? He said you have to wait for 13 times and so on. His view, too, was as good as 3 or 13.
But when you're defining what recidivism is and discussing recidivism, if you are operating under a false premise that someone has done something 3 times as opposed to 2 times, which is
recidivism either way, right?
Well, it's a different level of recidivism. If the court was taking the government up on its rhetoric, which was, this is three strikes, you're out. This is the third time. Maybe leniency is appropriate on the first or second time. And in fact, that's what the district court said. It said this is not the first or second time you did this.
What if he said it's not the 19th or 20th? It's the 21st.
I mean, then if we were at the 21st, then I think that would make a difference. I think that if his point were, this isn't the only time you've done this.
It wouldn't make any difference at that point, right? Whether it was 20 or 21, it wouldn't make any difference.
No, perhaps if that's what the court's words were, then it would. And I think the court specifically used those words, and it specifically picked up on the representations that the government had made throughout the hearing. So the court was certainly operating under the assumption that this was the third time. I think it's important that what happened here, there was only one previous sentence that Mr. Razo Nunez had received in regard to an unlawful reentry case. So he had only violated the terms of his supervised release once. He had not repeatedly violated the terms. This wasn't his repeated violation. He had only been undeterred once. There was only one sentence here. So if he had done this multiple times, that's different.
Let me make sure I understand.
Sure.
He violated the terms of his release by reentering.
Yes.
Right? And was that his, not his third reentry?
No, that
third
wasn't.
Third entry?
That was his third. That was his third entry. His second illegal entry. He had.
Oh, because he came here when he was 12. You mean?
Yes, no. He came here legally, and
as
that
a student, right?
On a student visa. Yes, and at no point in the hearing did anyone discuss that being illegal or that he had overstayed his visa or that there was anything inappropriate about that first entry. So. And the court's own words were, this is not the first or the second time that he illegally entered. Because of the government's three strikes, you're out rhetoric, I do think that it's important. It is very different here if you do think about this being the second time that he's violated or second time he's violated his supervision. And when you read the policy statements, introducing 7B.1 and 7B, the supervised release guidelines. They say that really those guidelines are aimed not at punishing the underlying offense, but in punishing the abuse of trust, essentially. And he had only abused the court's trust once. This was not the second time he had done that. If it were, it would be a different situation. And because of the court's language and because of the government's language, at the very least, I think, if there's a reasonable likelihood that the district court's sentence could change. And if that doesn't happen, then the record will be clear in this case. But it is very clear that the court was operating under a mistaken impression of fact. There's a clear mistake of fact here.
And there was no effort to correct that at the time that the statement was made.
There was no objection.
Yeah.
There was no objection. So we are in plain error, but I do think that in light of the error, the obviousness of the error, and the fact that the reasonable likelihood standard is not a terribly high standard to begin with, but certainly in the sentencing context, really, on a remand, I would doubt that this would take longer for the district court to address than today's oral argument.
We're not necessarily in plain error, are we? I thought two judges on the court believe it was.
And that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. That's something that I raised in the reply, that the two judges of the courts have undecided. But also, I did notice in preparing for oral argument that a case in 2011, United States v. Ventura, a three-judge unanimous panel, did cite that the clearly erroneous standard of review in its majority opinion as the law of the circuit. So perhaps under Ventura, it appears that the circuit has...
Was that the issue? Was there an issue about whether there had been an objection or not? That is, when it said clearly erroneous, did it take into consideration in Ventura?
It did not. After the court said clearly erroneous applies, it dropped a footnote that said the government is arguing that plain error applies. It doesn't matter here. So it did say that, but in the actual body of the opinion, it adopted the In Re sealed case concurrence clear error standard. So I do think that as far as that this is clear error, I think it's plain error. I think that at the very least we should allow the district court to resentence Mr. Raza Nunez under a correct view of the facts. And to be clear, what we're looking at is not whether or not this is not a substantive reasonableness issue. We're not looking at whether or not the district court could have reached the same sentence, but whether or not it would have, and that's the issue on that as with respect to that issue. With respect to the remaining issue, Mr. Raza Nunez challenges the district court's failure to consider the substance of his principal argument in mitigation in support of a lower sentence. More specifically, based on a mistake of fact, the district court expressly refused to consider that argument, based on a mistake of law, he expressly refused to consider that argument, and that was the argument under Smith. Prior to and at sentencing, Mr. Raza Nunez argued, based on the BOP policies, that his status as a deportable alien would cause a fortuitous increase in both the length and severity of his sentence. He relied on Smith, but asked for either a departure or a variance, not just a departure, a variance. And then he also, in arguing orally before the court, asked the court to take this into consideration with respect to where within the guidelines, if the court were looking at a guideline sentence, where within the guidelines his sentence should fall.
But he never made the argument that you're featuring now, which is that the entire assumption of the district court and both parties, I think, before the district court was just wrong, because we're not dealing with a situation in which the offense by nature involves somebody who's illegally reentered.
Counsel never made that specific argument. Counsel did ask the court to consider these factors.
Yeah.
And I would say that I think that he, by making the request, he preserves the issue, but he didn't make this specific argument. And when reviewing the case, it is very clear that the district court was operating under the assumption that this was a 2L1.2 case. Both of the circuit court cases that he relied on, in fact, expressly limit their reasoning to 2L1.2, and that's just not what was at issue here. As this court is aware, the court was sentencing under 7B1.1, 7B1.4. Those guidelines apply to all offenses, all defendants, whether they're citizens or non-citizens. So the district court in this case was not required to lower. We're not arguing that the district court was required to lower its sentence based on Smith, that that's automatic, but that it was required to consider the arguments that the defendant was making with regards to Smith. And again, whether it's a departure, a variance, or where within the guidelines the sentence would fall. This is clear procedural error under any standard of review. So to the extent that if the court were to find that it wasn't preserved, even though I believe that it was. The request was made. The arguments were made for why the court should consider these factors and why the Sentencing Commission didn't necessarily take them into account in constructing the guidelines. But to the extent plain error did apply, I think it also clearly meets that standard.
Are there other questions from the bench?
Time's expired. Thank you.
We'll hear from Mr. Smith for the government talking about the Smith case. Mr. Smith, I assume you have in front of you the transcript of the sentencing because that's what we're going to be talking about today. You have the sentencing transcript in front of you?
I have it.
Okay, let me ask you a couple questions. Does the government acknowledge that the district court was acting under the misapprehension that this was the defendant's third illegal entry?
When looking at the court, the district court's comment at sentencing
we'll look at what the analysis is in a moment, but does the government concede the district court was operating under the misapprehension that this was the defendant's third illegal entry?
I don't necessarily agree. The court's literal comments, understood literally and in isolation, the court's comment was inaccurate.
All right, let's talk about that. Let's start with the prosecutor's statement at page 3. I just want to note a couple of facts, Your Honor. One is that on the previous case that you had in front of you, which was another illegal reentry, which was the second time the defendant committed that crime, you went below the guidelines. So the defendant has already had leniency from this court, which was his second mistake. We're now past the third mistake. Now, it was not true that in the previous case, it was the second time the defendant had committed an illegal reentry, right? That is not true.
The chronology is incorrect.
It's not true, right?
Correct.
The government, I'm not saying this was intentional,
right,
but I am saying that the government misinformed the judge, correct?
Well,
he says that in the previous case, which was another illegal reentry, which was the second time the defendant committed that crime.
There were two illegal reentries. There was the case before Judge Bates initially. There was the second case before
Judge
talking, Uvell.
But he says there's no reference to Judge Uvell here. This is one is that on the previous case you had in front of you. That's the previous case that Judge Bates had in front of him.
Right.
Which was another illegal entry, which was the second time.
Right.
It was not the second time, right?
That's
right.
That sentence gives rise to that inference, but the prosecutor was far from precise in this section. And in these two pages...
That is an incorrect statement to the district court, correct?
It can be read that way.
How can that sentence be read another way?
Well, it could be read to mean that the prosecutor simply made a mistake about the chronology.
The prosecutor could have made a mistake, but what he told the judge wasn't correct. He may have made a mistake about what he told the judge, but what I'm not blaming the prosecutor in a sense of intentional misleading the court, but I want to know whether the court, in fact, got the wrong information there, and that statement is not correct, right?
That statement, and I guess I want to fill in my response to the court, because the prosecutor was referring to a lot of different things in these two transcript pages, pages 3 and 4, and it is true that, as you suggest, that sentence, read in isolation and read literally, can be read to be incorrect.
And that's the very first statement that the prosecutor made to the judge, right?
It is, but the prosecutor goes on to explain that he's talking about a variety of different things. He talks about crimes that appellant committed generally. He's talking about illegal entry.
Right. Now let's talk for a moment about what the judge thought. Now I want to take a look at page 18. You have page 18 in front of you?
I do.
All right. Now, we'll talk about the Smith departure, Mr. Smith, in a moment. But the judge says, having rejected the Smith departure, I conclude that a sentence on the high end of the guidelines is an appropriate sentence here. it is appropriate in terms of punishment, appropriate in terms of the nature of the offense, given the fact that this is not the first or second time that he entered illegally. That's the district court, correct?
Correct.
You have another interpretation of those words?
Well, again, read literally and in isolation, I think that that statement is incorrect, and that's what the government has indicated in the brief. But our argument is that this wasn't a plainly erroneous comment, and the reasoning is the same as our reasoning with respect to the prosecutor's comment. I think that what the prosecutor's underlying point was, there were two illegal entries, and there was also the violation of the conditions of supervised release. And that is a separate act. That is a separate violation of a court order.
But the district court doesn't appear to have understood it that way. He states, given the fact, and I emphasize the word fact because we're reviewing a factual error here, or alleged factual error, that this is not the first or second time that he's entered illegally. And that fact is false, correct?
That's incorrect.
All right. So if we were to conclude that the district court operated on a false fact, we would have to vacate the sentence and remand, would we not?
Not necessarily, because I guess I have two responses. One is we're concededly on plain error. Appellant argues that this is that the court's review is for plain error. That error is not plain or obvious. The defense counsel didn't object. I think that the parties, the participants of the sentencing proceeding.
That's not the question. The question is whether it's plain from appellate from the point of view today. That's what the Supreme Court has held, right?
Right.
And but the question is, if the judge says the fact is he entered three times, when the true fact is he entered two times, how can that not be plain?
It might not be plain because the actions of the participants in the sentencing proceeding give rise to the inference that what the court was really saying was that there were three violations, that there were two illegal entries, and there was the violation of the court's order on supervised release. So there were three violations of law, or three violations of the court's order, and that's what the court really meant. But even if...
Do you see any words in the district court statement there that suggests that?
We're arguing that that's a fair inference, but
from
that's not...
A fair inference of a sentence in which he says this is not the first or the second time he entered illegally?
Correct.
All right, now let's talk about the Smith issue for a moment. That begins on page 9. The court says, what Smith is also about is that this is something that the sentencing guidelines cannot be presumed to have accounted for. In this case, where everyone charged with this crime is an illegal alien, everyone, the presumption should be just the opposite. It should be that the Sentencing Guideline Commission is well aware of that, and took that into account in coming up with the appropriate recommendation in terms of sentencing. Now, he was, in fact, sentenced under 7B, not under 2L, right?
Correct.
7B is revocation. 2L is illegal reentry.
Correct.
And it is not true that everyone who's charged sentenced under 7B is an illegal alien, right?
That's correct.
Not even close. I mean, it's every single crime you could possibly commit.
Right. That's appellant's argument.
No, that's true. Not just an appellant's argument. That's true, isn't it?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then that's what the judge says on page 9. Then the judge says on page 15, where the offense is one that requires the status of a deportable alien, I don't think that that means that a Smith departure should be given, because that would mean for that offense there's always a Smith departure. And a Smith departure is really based on an individual not receiving certain benefits. Now, a Smith departure would not be required for everyone who's having their sentence, their supervised release revoked, correct?
Correct.
That's unrelated to whether you're an illegal alien or not.
Correct.
And then lastly, on page 16, the judge says, I would rely on the First Circuit case and the Seventh Circuit case. I'm persuaded by the reasoning of those decisions, explaining why a sentence reduction under Smith is not appropriate in an illegal reentry case. And he cites both Vasquez and Gonzalez-Portillo, correct?
Correct.
Both of those cases are expressly, as opposing counsel said, based on 2L, right?
Correct.
So why isn't opposing counsel correct that the district court was operating under the misapprehension that this was about 2L and not about 7B, and therefore the district court's judgment about Smith not applying is legally erroneous.
It may be, but I would suggest the court doesn't need to reach that question.
Well, first let me reach that question. Then after we decide that question, you can persuade me why I cannot reach it. Isn't it true? Isn't it true that all the judge's arguments about why he was not going to consider a Smith departure here were based on the misapprehension that this was a 2L rather than a 7B proceeding?
It may or may not have been. I don't think the record is entirely clear. The district court may have understood that, and he may have simply been saying that those cases are relevant because in the sentencing context, the court can consider all manner of different things. And the court may have been saying that appellant's underlying conduct is relevant, and it may have been looking at those cases with respect to appellant's the conduct that led to the original conviction.
There would be nothing in either of those cases, Vasquez or Gonzalez-Portillo, that would support that argument. In fact, in Vasquez, the court expressly says that we're going to limit our holding to 2L1.2 because that's the situation where everyone in that category is already an illegal entry.
Right.
So that case really would not, and basically the same thing is said in the Gonzalez-Portillo case. So but those cases really are not relevant if the judge is looking at something other than the point that 2L always covers such circumstances.
Well, I guess where I differ is that the court said that those cases were persuasive. It didn't indicate that those cases were binding.
I guess I don't want to add insult to injury here, but there's one quote that the chief judge didn't include, probably just because he had plenty of quotes at his disposal. But the district court also said on pages 15 to 16, it isn't that, okay, this offense automatically is entitled to a lower sentence. That's an effect that's being argued here, that this offense automatically entitles the individual convicted to a lower sentence because the individual always is going to be a deportable alien. Mm-hmm. So he's talking about this offense being the offense for which he's rendering a sentence. And that's just not true of this offense because it's a revocation of supervised release. So it seems hard to glean from that comment that he wasn't operating under the misimpression that the offense for which he was rendering sentence was an offense of illegal reentry.
He could have been, but there are other sections in the transcript read as a whole where it's not entirely clear that he was operating under that misapprehension. And
which sections of the transcript would you draw our attention to for that proposition with respect to the Smith departure?
Well, I think that the court makes clear that it is not looking at those cases as being binding or controlling.
Not controlling because they're not in the circuit, but he says he relies on their reasoning.
He does, and those cases informed the court's decision, but so did a lot of other factors. The court went on to talk about appellant's recidivism and appellant's the need for deterrence. It wouldn't have reached those things if it found those cases to be dispositive.
That was not in terms of rejecting a Smith departure. That was in terms of considering all the relevant factors and deciding on what the sentence was.
But the court continued to talk about the Smith departure. For example, it considered, appellant's argument is that the court didn't use its discretion at all.
That's, I think, an unfair reading of the appellant. The appellant's argument is the court understood that it had discretion with respect to sentencing, but did not understand that in exercising that discretion, it could apply a Smith departure. And that is their. I'm appropriately stating their argument.
You are. I think that's correct. And I disagree with that argument because throughout the sentencing proceeding, the court continued to talk about the Smith departure. On page 11, for example, it engaged defense counsel in talking about appellant's conditions of confinement. That is one of the factors that the court pointed to in Smith as being something that distinguished aliens from others who are incarcerated. So that goes directly.
Where is that? Where are you?
It's page 11 of the sentencing transcript.
Mm-hmm. Where are we talking about here? I see a lot of comments by Mr. Jeffress. I don't see the court. Mr. Jeffress is the defense counsel.
Court says, where is he going to be on a sentence that Judge Havel gave him? And
yes.
Defense counsel's response is Texas. And the reason they're talking about that is because the primary argument, and perhaps the only argument, appellant raised at sentencing was the applicability of the Smith departure. The defense counsel was trying to urge the court to apply the Smith departure. Right. That was the only contested issue at sentencing.
Right, but where do you see the district court saying that even if I could give a Smith departure, I wouldn't give one?
That doesn't say that directly, but the fact that it's already discussed the cases and the Smith departure, and it loops back around. Defense counsel is arguing that appellant's going to be incarcerated in Texas, and the fact that he didn't get the Smith, they're talking about the Smith departure.
But they're only talking about it because he's talking about it in the following sense. He's saying there's some certain considerations that gave rise to this doctrine of Smith, period.
Correct.
And his misimpression is those considerations are going to apply every single time because, as he says on the next page, a U.S. citizen couldn't be convicted of this offense, which is just not correct.
Well,
so
right.
It makes sense to talk about Smith because what his point is that, yeah, there's a bunch of considerations that give rise to Smith, but those considerations are going to be true every time because a U.S. citizen couldn't be convicted of this offense. So the mere fact that he's talking about those considerations doesn't, to me, in any way detract from the misimpression that he was operating under.
It certainly can be read that way. I would suggest that it can also be read an alternative way, which is that the court, when it's talking about offense, is talking about the underlying offense, not the revocation of the conditions of supervised release. So it's talking about the illegal entry, but that the ultimate point that the court is trying to make is that could still be applicable or could still be relevant in the context of revocation of supervised release because the offender's status would be unchanged as between the original offense and as between the revocation of supervised release. So
which words give you that inference?
The court doesn't state that directly.
And even indirectly. What words? Indirectly. The next case we have is all about implied messages. Give me the implied message here.
Well, the reason that I think that it's implied, and I'm sorry that I can't point to a specific statement made by the court. I think that when you look at the transcript in context, that our argument is this, that it continued to talk about the Smith departure throughout the sentencing transcript. It talked about appellant's arguments about whether appellant would be incarcerated in Texas. It did look at the underlying offense conduct. But it looked at a lot of other things, too. It looked at recidivism. It looked at the need for deterrence. It looked at appellant's conduct that was not appellant's offense conduct in this case, but what were offenses, state offenses, committed in Kansas. And it considered other things that
All of those things would have to be considered, whether he gave a Smith departure or not.
That's correct.
All right. Do we have any other questions from the bench? Look, I this is going to sound harsh, but... U.S. Attorney's Office has a noble tradition of confessing error in cases where it misadvised the court. And I have to say, at least for myself, I haven't seen very many where it should have. This seems like that kind of case to me.
Your point is well taken, and I guess I would just suggest that with respect to the allocution, and not the district court's comment, but with respect to the allocution, I do believe that what the prosecutor meant by his various arguments about using three strikes or three violations was that there were two illegal entries and that there was also a separate act, which was the violation of the conditions of supervision.
I understand, and I'm not suggesting intentional misstatement by the prosecutor. I'm just saying that when the prosecutor does make a misstatement and the judge repeats it, it seems very clear, at least to me, that the judge believes that to be the fact. It's not... Prosecutor may have made a mistake. I get that. That's very easy in a sentencing when you're standing up spontaneously. But when the district court sentences somebody based on a misapprehension, both of a fact and of the law, and when the only thing that we can do would be to send it back for a resentencing, at which he might well get the same sentence if what you're saying is true, seems like an appropriate case for the government to consider a confession of error. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, I understand that point, and we'll take that back and discuss it. I would say that...
I'm not trying to negotiate a settlement here.
I don't
think that's necessary.
I mean, I do take the court's comment, and I just would add that it is plain error view that defense counsel didn't take either the prosecutor's comment or the court's comment that way.
Point taken, that's correct.
And that has informed the way that we've litigated this case.
I understand that.
Thank you. We urge the court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Okay. You don't need any more time, do you? Case will be taken under submission.